Good evening. This is the KRFP Evening Report for Tuesday, September 16th, 2014. I'm Lee Robartis in the news tonight. Capone murder trial goes to jury. Democratic Idaho House candidate Gary Osborne tells his views. And Moscow City Council approves changes to sidewalk cafe rules. We'll have details on those stories and more coming up on the KRFP Evening Report. And live in the KRFP studios in Moscow, Idaho, I'm Lee Robartis, and this is the KRFP Evening Report. The jury in the murder trial of Charles A. Capone of Moscow has now started deliberating. Deputy Prosecuting Attorney Maya Vowles said during closing arguments today, Capone lied when he said Anderson left his shop at 7 p.m. April 16, 2010 to return to Lewiston, according to the Lewiston Tribune website's live blog. From the trial, Vowles told the jury Anderson's last cell phone call at 8:09 p.m. hit on the cell phone tower next to Capone's shop. Prosecutors say Capone killed his wife, Rachel Anderson, April 16, 2010, which was the last day she was seen. The main prosecution witness, Capone friend David C. Stone of Moscow, said he saw Capone strangle Anderson at his automotive shop on the 2200 block of South Main Street in Moscow. Stone said he and Capone wrapped Anderson's body in a tarp, weighed it down with chains, and dumped it into the Snake River at Red Wolf Crossing Bridge near Clarkston. Vowles said Capone was waiting for Anderson to make a decision about going forward with a divorce after giving her a 3-day ultimatum. She also referred to testimony about how Anderson told people she was being stalked and harassed and that she believed it would end in her death. Testimony also indicated Anderson believed Capone would kill her rather than let her go through with the divorce. The account says Vowles said, "What does he do? He strangles her." Vowles also spoke about how Anderson's family drove through the night in South Dakota to come to the area to help with the search when Anderson disappeared, but Capone did not help with the search. In his closing arguments, defense attorney Mark Monson said there was reasonable doubt about many aspects of Stone's story. Monson said if Capone had strangled Anderson with a glove that contained a fingertip found in Anderson's vehicle, there would be more than a trace of Anderson's DNA on it. Stone had made a deal with prosecutors to have the murder charge against him, which included receiving an immunity letter. Monson called the letter a license for Stone to lie. Monson also said much of Stone's timeline for the story of what happened April 16, 2010 did not match up. Defense attorneys for Capone finished their defense testimony yesterday, calling the final 11 witnesses, some of whom already had testified earlier in the trial. Most of the 11 witnesses only answered a few short questions yesterday. Presiding Judge Carl B. Carrick asked Capone outside the jury's presence if he was sure that he did not want to testify on his own behalf regarding the murder accusation. Capone said he did not want to take the stand. Montana began a six-month general hunting season for gray wolves yesterday. The hunt marks the fourth annual hunt since the U.S. Congress revoked endangered species protections for gray wolves in 2011 and the fifth hunt since 2009 when the gray wolf temporarily lost its protected status before it was restored by a federal judge that year. Activists are monitoring the killing of wolves that have left Yellowstone National Park by shadowing outfitters in wilderness areas adjacent to Yellowstone. The Yellowstone Wolf Patrol plans to use video cameras to document the killings. Yellowstone Wolf Patrol member Ron Coronado said they would not interfere with hunters, which is illegal, but would film wolf deaths. Coronado said, "We're hoping our presence here and taking video of it and photographing evidence can persuade Montana citizens to ask their governor to shut down the hunt outside the park." Montana law prohibits harassment of hunters, but tracking hunters is not illegal as long as nothing is done to disrupt the hunt itself. In an effort to bring its finances under control, Whitman County Commissioner signed a contract with the Government Finance Officers Association. Whitman County will pay Government Finance Officers Association $44,000 to assess the county's financial procedures and policies and give recommendations in areas they see needing improvement. A 2012 state audit said Whitman County's financial department lacked internal controls and was not able to reconcile monthly bank transactions and general ledger entries. The report said the unsupported financial transactions and variances are pervasive and could have a material effect on the financial statements. The county was unable to provide sufficient support for significant adjusting journal entries or determine the cause of material variances between bank activity, accounting records, and amounts presented in its financial reports. The Government Finance Officers Association works with local governments and public entities to resolve financial difficulties which might lead to credit rating cancellations, such as the one imposed on Whitman County earlier this year. With about 18,000 members, GFOA is the nation's leading association for public finance policies and procedures. The entity will look at staff levels and training and will consider how efficiency can be improved in existing processes. The association will also look into accounting policies and whether they are up to date, adequate, and meet state reporting requirements. The action stems from 9 consecutive years of statements from the state auditor's office, which said Whitman County failed to meet its financial responsibilities. That led to Standard & Poor's Rating Services to suspend the county's credit rating for general obligation bonds. County Auditor Eunice Coker said the county's credit rating could be restored with the completion of a 2013 state audit, which is now underway. We now continue our series of area candidate interviews, this time with a candidate in an Idaho legislative race. Democrat Gary Osborne of Troy is running against Republican Caroline Nilsen Troy of Genesee and Independent David Suswell of Moscow for the District 5 House seat now held by Democrat Shirley Ringo. Osborne visited the KRFP studios today. Here is...
I was on a school board for 10 years in the Troy Deary area, and 95 out of 115 school districts now have to pass a supplemental. And supplementals are just to operate the school. They're not talking about bonds and that kind of thing. My view is that I think the legislature is charged by our Constitution to take care of the day-to-day spending. Not probably the buildings. And when you have 95 out of 115 having to pass supplementals, it's significant. And I think we're going to have to raise funding from the state level. I just give you an idea. In Troy School District, for instance, it's we spend our supplementals about $2,700 per student. So when they talk about we're at the bottom of every educational category, we have to make that up in educating our children at the local level. So when they say they're cutting taxes, they're cutting taxes at the state level. It's more of a tax shift. It shifts to the local.
Okay. Well, there was a primary where there were a lot of contested Republican seats, and I was wondering if you thought the primary season this year was something of a referendum on the going along with the Federal Affordable Health Care Act.
Well, it seems like it. I mean, I'm a supporter of the Affordable Health Care Act, and the other thing that one of my biggest reasons for running is to try to get Medicaid expansion passed in Idaho. We've lost the last 2 years already $180-190 million of funding. If you make less than $12,000 a year in Idaho, you're not eligible. You're on your own. And you earn the Indigent Care Fund in Latah County alone. Last year, it was about $750,000 out of the county coffers to pay for indigent care, plus the state. Then you go to the catastrophic fund. So seems nonsense. It's political. It's not economic, and it's not good for people in Idaho to pull themselves up. When they have health care, they can go out and get jobs other than to worry about sitting around and worried about where they're going to go to get their health care. If they have Medicaid, they can start the process of lifting themselves out of poverty, and that's what we have to do, in my opinion.
What do you think is going to be the upshot of the new law allowing concealed weapons on campuses in Idaho?
You asked the upshot.
I think I worded that poorly. What do you think is going to happen with that?
I don't know. I see Boise State got some extra monies to do some of the concealed weapons parameters as far as doing metal detectors and safes for lockdown and that kind of thing. Idaho isn't doing anything. There's some huge inconsistencies in the law. I wasn't for the law. Law enforcement wasn't for the law. Educators weren't for the law. Presidents of the colleges weren't for the law. And the legislature went ahead and passed it anyway.
Okay. And it seems that passed mainly because the National Rifle Association lobbyists wanted it. And there's also a large lobbying arm of industry that's nationwide that's targeting legislatures in particular, and that's ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. Do you have any comments on that? Or, you know, do you think you might get involved in that?
Well, you know, I say Idaho Solutions for Idaho, and I think that these outside influences we've had come into our state, especially guns on campus, those aren't Idaho problems that needed Idaho solutions. We need to concentrate on that. Don't let outside influence on both sides, both parties. We need to concentrate on what's good for Idaho. We need to make investments for Idaho. And I look at it that way. The politics and the groups, they need to stay on the sidelines, and we need to do what's best for Idaho.
Okay. There's a new ag gag law preventing filming of agricultural operations without permission. There's a lawsuit over that right now. What are your thoughts on the legislature passing something like that?
Well, I've been a farmer for over 40 years, and when I grew up, we had a pig farm, to be honest, and we butchered, and we had cattle, and we had chickens. And when I grew up, when we were butchering animals, it wasn't any fun. It affected me. I didn't like it, but that's what it is. If you're going to eat meat, it's part of the process. I can see where people are put off of it. I think maybe if we would do an educational program with people that are very against, you know, the industry, the whole industry, instead of trying to gag them and not take pictures, I think we take them out, show them, do those kinds of things, because it's not pleasant. I mean, nobody that is in that industry thinks it's pleasant. It's just what we have to do. I mean, when we work on animals, if they get sick, those are unpleasant things to do, too, also. So I think education, other than the ag gag bill, would be my preferred way to go.
Do you think there's something that I've observed, and I was wondering if you agree, that Idaho tends to pass laws that get thrown out as unconstitutional. Ag gag hasn't been decided yet. There's also the constitutional amendment against gay marriage, and the Idaho spending a lot of money defending that, and there's been various abortion laws over the years. What are your thoughts on this legislative tendency to do that?
Yeah, well, you know, I look at everybody's rights should be protected, and no one should have special rights, and no one should have less rights. I've always said and thought we should not judge anyone, and it's not our place to judge anyway by the pigment in their skin or by who they love. We don't. It's none of our business. I think it's up to the individual, and that's what gets us in trouble is when we look at the rights, take away their rights, and I'm for keeping their rights, everybody's rights.
Okay, what do you feel about the new rules which allow, with a certain Idaho Transportation Department process, 129,000-pound trucks on certain roadways in northern Idaho? There was a recommended approval of U.S. 95 from Grangeville to Lewiston to allow those sorts of trucks recently.
Yeah, I think that's some of the lumber places coming down, getting to a railhead. I believe that was what that initiative was, coming from Grangeville down to the railhead at Spalding. The 129 targeted areas, I don't know. I know that the 129,000 pound rule is in Canada. We would hope that it would make shipping cheaper if we adopted it. Some of our roads just aren't able to be using 129,000. They're not. The corners are too tight. There's all kinds of things in Idaho. So maybe targeted areas, but as far as blanket 129,000-pound law in North Idaho would be not advisable, in my opinion.
That was Democratic candidate for state legislature Gary Osborne of Troy, who is running against Republican Caroline Nilsen Troy of Genesee and Independent David Suswall of Moscow for the District 5 House seat now held by Democrat Shirley Ringo. Osborne was in the KRFP studios today. In the other District 5 House race, Democrat Paulette Jordan is running against Republican incumbent Cindy Agidius. In the District 5 Senate race, Republican John Carlson is running against incumbent Democrat Dan Schmidt. The winner in all three races will serve two-year terms. District 5 includes Latah and Benoit counties. You're listening to the KRFP Evening Report. This is KRFP Moscow Pullman. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers has halted its review of a plan by Amber Energy of Australia to build a coal terminal on the Columbia River at Umatilla, Oregon. Oregon regulators rejected the proposed terminal last month, and the Army Corps review is halted until Amber Energy's appeal of Oregon's decision is decided. Corps spokesperson Scott Clemens told the Associated Press, given the lack of clarity right now as to whether the required state authorization is going to happen, and given the amount of time and energy needed, we still need to devote to this project. It doesn't make sense to devote resources to a project that may not happen. The Moscow City Council last night approved an amendment to the Downtown Sidewalk Cafe ordinance to allow outdoor seating for restaurants to expand to the sidewalk outside of neighboring businesses during certain downtown events under certain conditions. Under the rules adjustment, sidewalk seating would be allowed to abut a neighboring business's property line rather than their own property line, thereby expanding the available area for a sidewalk cafe presence for an establishment. All other restrictions would still apply. Establishments would be required to file an amended sidewalk cafe licensed area diagram with the city clerk and would be required to include written permission from the neighboring business allowing the extension of the area in front. City Attorney Rod Hall explained the council was actually considering an ordinance change plus a separate resolution last night.
We have two things for tonight. One is going to be an amendment to our ordinance on the sidewalk cafe ordinance to allow the city council at their discretion to pass resolutions to, in the future, if they want to expand the use of sidewalk cafes for events, that they will have the authority. And then the second one we have for you is actually a specific resolution to exercise that amendment on that resolution. This is concerning the City of Moscow in partnership with Chamber of Commerce in hosting the downtown block party. I think it's the Vandal Town block party. Set to happen here in Moscow on September 26, 2014, kind of to welcome back the new and returning students and kind of introduce them to the downtown community and actually celebrate our community as a whole. The event will be on Main Street. It'll be from A Street down to 6th Street. That's downtown will be closed. 3rd Street east to west would be left open so traffic can continue to flow through east and west. The idea behind amending the sidewalk cafe ordinance is to allow established businesses down there that exercise the sidewalk cafe to be able to expand their business during that event to kind of bring more of a festive and enticing atmosphere for the event. And it's also to provide an incentive for the businesses to participate. So it is proposed that the restrictions relating to the sidewalk cafe be adjusted for this event and as a pilot for future potential events.
That was Moscow City Attorney Rod Hall. Both the ordinance change and the resolution passed unanimously. Well, that's it for the KRFP Evening Report for tonight. Taking a look at the weather, partly cloudy, low 53. Tonight, partly sunny. Tomorrow, high 84. Mostly cloudy, low 52. Wednesday night, and a 20% chance of showers and thunderstorms. In the afternoon on Thursday, otherwise mostly cloudy, high 78, with west winds gusting to 20. Mostly cloudy, low 50 Thursday night, and mostly clear skies Friday through Sunday, with highs of 72 Friday, 78 Saturday, and 84 on Sunday, lows around 47. Currently, fair skies, 82 degrees in Moscow. Thanks for tuning in to the KRFP Evening Report. We do have Department of Environmental Quality real-time air monitoring, and the air quality in Moscow and Potlatch is good. Air quality in Kendrick and Lewiston is moderate, and same with Cottonwood, and the air quality is unhealthy in Grangeville. Thanks for tuning in to the KRFP Evening Report. Coming up next, our weekly documentary from Making Contact, followed by Flashpoints, the daily investigative news magazine from Pacifica Radio. Music begins with Dave Weaver's Tuesday Night Grab Bag at 7:30. If you want to help KRFP keep newscasts like this on the air, plus the newscasts you hear during Morning Mix, be sure to buy raffle tickets. KRFP is giving away a Jamis Citizen 2 bicycle, customizable to your frame, and you can buy tickets at the station, 114 East 3rd Street in Moscow, best times afternoon and evenings, or at Moscow Farmers Market from 8 a.m. till 1 p.m. on Saturdays in downtown Moscow, or from KRFP DJs. I'm Lee Robartis. Jim Roach assists with tonight's newscast. Have a pleasant evening. This is KRFP Moscow Pullman.